Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make TWiT even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey. This is Triangulation, episode 238, recorded Monday, February 22nd, 2016. The future of professions. Triangulation is brought to you by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/triangulation. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost, automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the simplest way to create a landing page or beautiful website for your portfolio, your blog, your business, your online store. Enter the offer code Triangulation and you'll get 10% off Squarespace. You should. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting, smartest people in technology and learn a thing or two. And we got two of them today. Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind are the authors of a new book, The Future of Professions. We've been talking a lot on Triangulation about the changing world of work and what future technologies are going to bring for us and our children. And that's what this book is all about. Professor Susskind, thank you for joining us. Daniel, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
It's good to be with you.
Yeah. From the UK, great to be with you. I take it.
Yes, indeed. We're both in London, although not together in London.
Ah, yeah. But father and son.
Father and son.
It's not an amazing coincidence. It's a reason why you share a name.
Yes.
Richard, this is not new ground for you, because you've written a couple of books already about law, including The End of Lawyers?
Yeah, the question mark is very important there.
Because I take it the answer is no.
Well, what I was looking at then, as now in fact, was the way in which technology in particular might change the work of lawyers. And it seemed to me that when we looked at a lot of legal work and we examined the extent to which various information technologies might be used, then this presented both a challenge to lawyers, because it seems to me in the future there would be less for lawyers to do, but actually a great benefit potentially for the users of legal services. So fundamentally, my interest was in the availability of legal advice and legal dispute resolution online. So law, like so many other areas, would be brought into the internet age.
And I take it you are a solicitor or a lawyer yourself?
I'm a Scots lawyer by background, actually. You may hear the trace of my accent.
I hear a little
here.
Scots. But I should point out the president of the Society for Computers and Law, IT advisor to the Lord Chief Justice in the UK, and chair of the advisory board of the Oxford Internet Institute. So I think your qualifications are good here. Daniel, you're a lecturer in economics at Balliol, but also a former Kennedy scholar from Harvard University. So and an advisor in the government to the Prime Minister's strategy unit at 10 Downing. So we've got some pretty good credentials here. Were you aiming, Daniel, this book at those policymakers? Was this a kind of a message to government about how to go forward into the 21st century?
Mm. So in part it is. It's exactly that. I mean, it's also designed for professionals and for people who are thinking about going into the professions and wondering what the future might look like. It's meant to describe what that world will be.
And it's technology that's really making the difference here.
That's right. So in the book, we set out two futures for the professions, and both of those futures sort of rely upon technology. There's one future which is reassuringly familiar, we say, and that's just simply a more efficient version of what we have today. Professionals use technology to streamline and to optimize the traditional ways in which they've worked, you know, largely since the middle of the 19th century. So, you know, doctors talking to patients via Skype, teachers drawing on online materials in the classroom, you know, architects using computer-assisted design software to design bigger and more complicated buildings. You know, so that's the first future. But then there's a second future, which is a very different proposition, and we spend quite a lot of time looking at that in the book. And here, technology not only streamlines and optimizes the traditional ways in which professionals work, but it actively displaces the work of traditional professionals. And while we think that for now and in the medium term, these two futures, both of which rest on technology, will develop in parallel, in the long run, we expect that second future to dominate.
That has to be quite a shock, Richard, for professionals. I mean, we always think of technology replacing manual labor, the assembly line. But highly trained professionals like doctors and lawyers, we always figure, well, hey, we're secure in that. And I think the fact that schools are still cranking them out at a great pace indicates people think there's a bright future for this. What is the future for? Let's talk about the law. What is the future for the law? How could a lawyer be replaced by a robot?
There's a different way of tackling that question. It's true of most of the professions, and that's to ask and answer the question, to what extent are legal services, court services, legal advice from lawyers, are they really accessible and available and affordable today?
That's a good point.
The trouble with many of our professions, law included, is that the professions are creaking. We can't afford them. Most people, unless they're well off, can't use them. And so our starting point is not so much how do we streamline and improve the old ways of working, but almost thinking from a blank sheet of paper, what might it look like if we had the opportunity to design a legal system from scratch? So to give you one example, for instance, I'm heavily involved in England and Wales just now in the development of online courts. We ask the question, is court a service or a place? Do you really need physically to congregate together to resolve your differences? If you've got a low-value claim, does it make sense to pay some intermediary, the lawyer, more than the amount at issue, to wait many months, maybe years to resolve the problem, even to assemble in a courtroom with wood paneling and people wearing wigs? It seems to us that this is antiquated. And so our government, our judiciary, and supported by the work we've been doing, is suggesting that we can have online courts. For example, judges can decide cases not by appearing before the parties or the other way around, but actually by looking at the papers and perhaps even using the phone or video conferencing. But what about online legal advice? If you want to know what your entitlements are, what you're prohibited from doing, what powers the law grants you, just now, again, you need to take legal advice. But we're seeing the emergence of our systems that offer punchy, practical, jargon-free guidance in all manner of legal issues. And you can sense the direction we're going in here, where historically you'd have required lawyers to offer advice and to represent individuals in courts. As more and more of this legal material and legal service becomes available online, there's less need for the traditional lawyer.
It's less that lawyers and doctors are going to go away, more that their function, their job will be different. I would add to that university professors, because thanks to the Internet, information is freely available. You know, two of our sponsors, and it's not surprising because our sponsors tend to be kind of new technology companies, are about disintermediating the professions. One is a company, probably, I don't know if you have it in England, you probably don't, but called LegalZoom, which is about doing a lot, as you say, a lot of the legal work without actually having to talk to a lawyer. The other is, actually, there are several of these investment advisors that are computers, not humans, and do probably a better job, I might add, than the humans do. But it does seem to me that we'll still need teachers and doctors and lawyers. It's just a different role they're going to play.
And so one of the unhelpful things we do when all of us, when we try and think about the future of work, is that we tend to talk about the different jobs that people do.
Right.
So we talk about doctors and nurses and teachers and accountants and so on. But the term job isn't entirely illuminating for the kind of reasons you're hinting at, which is that it encourages us to think of work, the work that they do, as a sort of monolithic, indivisible lump of stuff. Right. When actually, if you look under the bonnet of any professional job, professionals do lots and lots of different activities, lots and lots of different tasks in their role. Just to take a prosaic example, a nurse today does very, very different tasks in the UK from the sort of things that a nurse will have done 25 years ago. You know, 25 years ago, it might have involved bedpans and bedside conversation. Today in the UK, nurses can perform minor operations and prescribe certain types of medication. The problem is that we use the term job, nurse, to describe two very, very different things. And in the same way, when we think about the future, we have to be careful not to anticipate that the sorts of tasks, the sort of activities that are gathered under the title of doctor or nurse or teacher or accountant won't change because of technology. It's also important to say, you know, when we published our book, The Economist did a review of it, and alongside the piece, and it was a good piece, alongside the piece was a cartoon of Professor Dr. Robot QC. It was a robot with a stethoscope and a wig and a fat ledger of papers under his arm. And I think that's the mindset that lots of people have when they think about the future of work, that one day Professor Dr. Robot QC or one of his relatives will, you know, displace a doctor or a teacher from their job. And that's simply not what will happen. What you see is technology displacing some tasks and activities, but also giving rise to new tasks and new activities. And there's this underlying churn and change in the sorts of things that professionals do is what we really need to be paying attention to in thinking about the future of work.
About 20 years ago, I interviewed an economist named Jeremy Rifkin, and he had written a book called The End of Work, in which he foretold mass unemployment as the labor market disappeared thanks to automation and technology. But he thought there would be an elite of professionals running the place while everybody else is on the breadlines. It looks like everybody's vulnerable this time, but in different ways.
I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
The common assumption, and the assumption we're challenging, is that somehow professionals are immune from the kinds of changes we're anticipating, and that, of course, manual workers and, of course, administrative workers will somehow disappear, but somehow the professions are impregnable. One of our running themes, however, is what we call decomposition. If you break down professional work into component parts, it's a kind of new division of labor. If you break it down, you often find that the parts involved, or many of them at least, are actually quite routine and repetitive. They're administrative, they're process-based. And it's only a relatively small number of parts of the professional's daily work that actually require creativity or judgment or deep expertise. And so what we're saying is, to make professions more affordable, it makes sense to chunk up the work and to, right, where possible, either to automate that work or use innovative technologies to change the work, or sometimes to allow far less expert people to do the work for themselves.
Well, you make a really good example in medicine, for instance. People say, well, I don't want to be told about my cancer by some robot. I want somebody with some feelings and empathy. But you point out that can often be decoupled. Often the most expert surgeon is not the best, does not have the best bedside manner. And here in the States, where we're really struggling with the cost of medicine, you see a lot more nurse practitioners in those traditionally more touchy-feely, human-scale things, doing, you know, the patient interaction. Although all that does to me is elevate the physician to an even more godlike status.
Well, it depends what the nurse practitioner is doing. One model we have is that nurse practitioner will be working with an intelligent technology, some kind of diagnostic system or perhaps some kind of treatment planning system. So what the patient receives is very accurate, up-to-date diagnostics of their condition, but delivered by what we call an empathizer. Indeed, one of the new roles we anticipate for the 20s is people who are excellent at empathizing, sitting
right
down with, putting themselves in the shoes of those who are recipients of bad news, and that might be bad news about their legal position, about their financial position, about their health. And as you rightly point out, it's not self-evident that technical specialists are the best people to call on when there's tragic news to impart. And
I think you want expertise too. If somebody's giving you a diagnosis that is, prognosis of 6 months to live, you would like that person to also know what he's talking about or she's talking about. Similarly, a lot of the reason you go to an attorney is for handholding and counsel, but that counsel is often about, well, here's what the process is going to be. Here's what's going to look like. You do need some expertise. The experience of the attorney is a big part of what makes that attorney's advice valuable.
So here's the question, Leo. What happens if the systems start outperforming human beings? We're seeing evidence of this in a number of areas.
Well, in cars, they're better drivers than we are. We know that.
And that's just one illustration. But if it comes to diagnosing your illness or your legal position or your tax position, we anticipate a future, and it's not overnight. We want to stress that. But it seems to us that all the suggestions are that the emerging technologies, whether they be systems like Watson or applications of big data, we're seeing systems that are emerging that are beginning to outperform human beings. And although you're absolutely right, people want to sit down with someone deeply expert, if the era arrives where systems, in some sense, are offering more reliable, more accurate, more up-to-date information and guidance and diagnostics than human experts, then that challenges our conventional assumptions again.
What do you see the argument that, well, this is just chipping away at the edges of what these professions do, but the core of what they do, arguing a case in court, no, Watson, as good as he is probably never going to be very good at arguing a case in court. So the core of these professions remains, doesn't it? Go ahead, Daniel, and then...
Thanks. Yeah, I think there's two responses to that. One is that in the book, we're challenging that assumption that these complicated, difficult, non-routine tasks necessarily make up a large chunk of what it is that professionals do. Again, when you decompose professional work, not everything, and in cases not very much, that a lawyer does is standing up in court.
Right.
And you see this again and again and again in the professions. We call it the argument from hard cases, picking the most difficult task or activity that a professional currently does, whether or not it's a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer, and saying, because that can't necessarily be done any differently, so too for everything else that the professional does. But there's a point about what's happening out there in the world that we see systems and machines already starting to take on tasks that previously we thought were at the core of what a professional does. LegalZoom, for example, it's the best recognized legal brand in the US. It isn't a traditional law.
Yeah.
It provides online document drafting service and guidance, the sort of thing that is at the core of what a traditional professional does, a traditional lawyer does. Again, in the legal world, on eBay 2 years ago, and I think it was again last year as well, 60 million disputes arose, and they were resolved online using what's called an e-mediation platform without any traditional lawyers at all. Now, that sort of task, the task of resolving a dispute, that's what lawyers think is at the core of their work. Now, in the tax world, last year, 48 million Americans used online tax preparation software. Right. Rather than a traditional tax accountant. Again, going to the core of what tax accountants do.
And, of course, there's the wonderful case of Joshua Browder, who saved motorists £2 million by creating an automated ticket appeal system, donotpay.co.uk. And
we're seeing more and more of these systems emerge. Just to go back to your point about advocacy in the courtroom, I do want to underline again that certainly in England, and I understand the American Bar Association are looking at these systems too. For all but the very most complex and high-profile and high-value cases, which I think still will involve people congregating in courtrooms, within 10 years, it's our guess, most of these cases will be resolved substantially through online courts. And the skills one needs to participate in these dispute resolution processes are very different from the traditional lawyering. Indeed, we're designing systems so that self-represented litigants can pursue most of their own actions themselves. And so we make assumptions when we're jumping to the future that certain core areas of work will still be there. And our book challenges that. We say, actually, there might be, and we use this phrase a lot, there might be entirely different ways of sorting out and solving the problems for which historically the professions have been the only solution. With the advent of technology, we're seeing new ways of sorting out old problems. Something entirely different, for example, take, you mentioned empathy. Take a system like a service, an online service like Patients Like Me, an online community, particularly useful for chronically unwell patients who can gather together and share their experiences of their illnesses, their pains, the therapies and the medications that work for them, those that didn't work for them. Practical, everyday advice, interestingly, not delivered by specialist medical practitioners, but often offering the comfort and the empathy and the interpersonal human contact that is so vital. Now, we've assumed in the past that that empathy and the comfort and the interpersonal contact comes from the professional. In the days of social networking now, as we can assemble together virtually, a lot of that kind of service or facility or help or guidance, support, can be offered by what we call communities of experience. People who've been recipients of professional service who are happy to share the experience with others.
And you see this across the professions. So Patients Like Me, that's 350,000 people who are receiving guidance or sharing their own experiences. But and that's the medical world. But in the tax world, for example, if you're using TurboTax's automated tax preparation software, there's an online community there, Answer Exchange, made up of people who are also trying to muddle through and fill out their tax return on time. Similarly, Khan Academy in education, say online collection of practice problems and instructional videos. It's got, I think it's about 10 million unique users a month, which is, you know, in a way, a higher effective attendance than the entire school population of England.
Yeah.
It's a huge number of people. One of the most useful things about that site isn't the videos and the practice problems. It's the online community of fellow students who are grappling and trying to make their way through the problem. And often seeing, hearing insight from one of your fellow students is a far better way to understand how to solve a problem.
Yeah, we've known that for years, that peer teaching is actually a very, very effective, maybe more effective than the traditional model. We'll have more with Daniel and Richard in just a second. Our show today brought to you by Texture. Now, if you love triangulation, it's because you are a big thinker, you like ideas. And I think magazines remain still one of the great places to read really good writing, great reporting, beautiful photojournalism. But really, do we want a bunch of magazines cluttering up the house or the apartment, our coffee tables weighed under? And it also, there's the guilt of having all those magazines and not reading them cover to cover. Texture solves all this. It is the best way to describe it. It's like Netflix for magazines. You play one low rate and you get all the magazines, all the articles. And I don't just mean samples. I mean, you get everything that's on the newsstand today, cover to cover, plus back issues. And you even get stuff you can't get in the magazine. Bonus features like video. I love Texture. This is such a great idea. They make it very easy to kind of, like you binge watch on Netflix, binge read. Because they even have this wonderful curated section where you can just deep dive into a single topic across a variety of magazines. They also have editor's picks. You get all the magazines you know and love. I mean, everything like Macworld and Time and Men's Fitness and Wired. And yes, the gossip magazines, People and Entertainment Weekly. I have to admit, it's... While I probably, don't want to buy those, at least I don't want anybody to know I buy them, it's really nice to have them, especially when you got time to kill in an airplane or just, I wonder, what's the latest with Blake Shelton and Gwen Stefani? What's going on there? Well, now I know, thanks to Texture. Texture makes it easy to find the articles you care about. Their editorial team will put together packages of articles that might appeal to you from magazines like Forbes and People and Newsweek. You don't have to waste time looking for content. And, I have to say, there's always one article I want to read in Rolling Stone every month and Esquire every month, but I don't want to get that whole magazine just for that. I don't want to subscribe. That all of that would be too expensive. For roughly the cost of about three magazines, you can get all the magazines every month at Texture. Look, there's a free trial. You should just try it. You'll get hooked, I warn you. Texture.com/triangulation. If you're still buying magazines or subscribing, this is a much better way. And if you haven't looked at a magazine in years because, we're all internet savvy, You might find some wonderful stuff like National Geographic every month. Just paging through that. Man, the photography's great in there. The writing in magazines like GQ and Esquire, just fantastic. I just love it. I want and Vanity Fair, right? If you like to look at fashion, they've got all the fashion magazines, too. Yes, the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issues there, too. It's Texture. Texture.com/triangulation. Try it free right now. We thank them so much for their support of Triangulation. We're talking about the future of professions with two experts, Richard Suskind and Daniel Suskind, father and son, who one is a Scottish lawyer and the other a scholar. And both are experts in not just the legal profession, but in how the world is changing. It's of course a fascinating subject because it's patently obvious that it's happening right now in front of us. Although I think people might argue that it's not necessarily an improvement. If you were, if you said, I have the skills to be truly expert at one of these fields as a physician or a lawyer, you should still pursue that field, I would think. Yes?
We're asked a lot by parents and by aspiring professionals. Should I go into the profession? Should I become a doctor or a lawyer? And then you need to reframe that question. If you take law, for example, I think many aspiring law students think of Suits or The Good Wife or Rumpel of the Bailey.
Yeah.
Or John Grisham, all of which I love, incidentally. But they think that's the kind of law they're going to practice. But that's 20th century law.
Yeah.
And similarly, all manner of box sets that deal with hospital emergencies and so forth. But that's, again, substantially 20th century medicine. Our view is you should go into medicine if you're interested in improving people's health and well-being. Not that you're interested in the particular ways that hospital doctors and primary care health specialists and so forth work today. Similarly, in law, you should go into law because you're interested in access to justice, not because you're interested in practicing law the way perhaps your parents did or your uncle or your friends. The great privilege for the generation coming through just now, and this is given to very few generations, is that young people joining the professions can play a role in shaping the way in which the problems that their professions sort out. And that very rarely happens. Ordinarily, you go into a profession, you take the baton from the person the year ahead of you, and you carry on in the same tradition. But what we're seeing is, because of technology, and our argument, broadly speaking, is we're living in a time of more rapid and more fundamental technological change than humanity has ever seen. This is a fantastic opportunity to grasp. And if you're an aspiring doctor or lawyer, accountant or teacher, be part of the great wave of change that this new technology is going to bring. And you say, some would say, that perhaps this will result perhaps in a diminishing of the service. But two ways of looking at this. One of our big interests is the many billions of people around the world who receive no education at all, who receive, for all intents and purposes, no healthcare at all, who have no way of understanding or enforcing their entitlements. So one thought is that a lot of the online service, as the internet becomes more widely available across our world, that online service will actually empower, it'll enable people who previously were completely alienated from health and education, from law and business and so forth, to pursue, it seems to us, better lives. The second question is, will this kind of technology and development improve the quality of the service for those people who can currently already afford the service? And that's more of a debate, because many people like the idea of the professional as craftsperson, just as they like a handmade kitchen. They might like the idea of a fine professional at the peak of his or her powers wrestling over an intellectual problem and fashioning some wonderful solution. Our big point is we can't really afford that kind of service for most people.
So you're really, I mean, I hate to, first of all, I absolutely love what you said, which is you should pursue a profession. The motivation shouldn't be, I love the way it's performed. I'm not a proceduralist. Your motivation should be, I want to participate in this profession because I want to make a difference. I want to make a change. Because one doesn't know what the procedures will be. And you could even argue, as I have many times, and I'm not sure that the Kurzweilian singularity is really imminent. I hold on to this notion that there is something kind of fundamentally different between human thought and computer thought. I could very well be wrong. It'd be foolish to plan your career the next 50 years on that bet, one way or the other. So don't get attached to how it's done. I like that idea. That makes.
Can I make a related point?
Sure.
Many people say that because machines won't be able to think as human beings, and I think you were coming close to that yourself, and in fact, we come close to that ourselves, then there's certain activities that are simply beyond the scope of systems, and therefore professionals would be safe. People would want to say, for example, judgment.
You don't want a computer judging.
No, I didn't mean that, although we can get that in a second. I meant a doctor, an accountant.
Oh, yeah. Should we operate or should we not?
Judgment. The question often is asked to us, how can a computer exercise judgment? We think that's the wrong question. We think the better question is, to what problem is judgment the solution? Why do we call upon our experts to exercise judgment? And the answer to that, we believe, is because we live in a world of uncertainties.
Yeah.
Often the facts are uncertain, often the knowledge is uncertain. So you ask human beings or experts to draw on their experience, and based on that experience, to exercise what we call their judgment. But what we're seeing in the world of big data and brute force processing is machines that can actually handle uncertainty far more effectively than human beings. So rather than a doctor who's maybe seen 1,000 patients with a particular condition, a machine might have a database of 10 million. Rather than a lawyer who's handled a couple of hundred of cases, a machine might have a database of several hundred thousand. And so it may interest you, for example, and listeners too, that there's a system called Lex Machina, which can actually effectively predict the decisions of patent courts more accurately than any human lawyer. Now, if you're a client, you tend to want to ask this question. You want to say, what's my chances of winning? That's the big question you're asking. And this system can answer that question more accurately than the lawyers, but it knows nothing about the law. What it essentially is doing is making a statistical prediction about the behavior of the courts, the judges involved, the particular lawyers involved. Given the nature of the subject matter, given the amount at issue, it's now possible to make a statistical prediction that is more accurate than reasoning with the law. And that is why in medicine people are saying that data science will trump medical science. And in audit and accounting, we're going to see, and particularly in audit, you're going to see the use of systems that will essentially replace audits because they can detect anomalies using the kind of techniques I know you've discussed in your program before, massive data processing capabilities. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not for a second saying these machines are intelligent in the way human beings are, but they're sorting out these problems in different ways.
And that's such an important point. You know, the temptation of all of us is to say that because a machine can't reason like a human being, it can't exercise judgment. Or because a machine can't think like a human being, it can't be creative. Or because a machine can't feel like a human being, it can't be empathetic. That's the temptation of all of us. But the mistake we're making there is to fail to recognize that many of these systems and machines can perform tasks that might have required creativity, judgment, or empathy from a human being, but they perform them in very, very different ways. It goes to your point about not being proceduralist about it. The question is, how do we solve most efficiently and most effectively a given outcome? And the way in which we've traditionally done it, by relying upon particular types of human faculties, might not necessarily be the only way to do it in the future.
I'll certainly grant you that a computer is better than any human at weighing statistical odds and churning huge amounts of data. Do you not think, though, that there is something called intuition? Do you not think that creativity is something more than a mechanical process?
Oh, absolutely. But the bigger question is, given that intuition and creativity are skills and talents and capabilities that human experts draw upon, the bigger question is, can the same outcome or better be achieved by machines that don't have these capabilities, but instead of brute force? So in 1997, when Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion, was beaten by Deep Blue, IBM's system. No one was really suggesting, surely, that that computer system had his genius, his intuition, his creative capabilities. He was beaten by brute force. He was beaten by a system that could process up to 330 million moves in 1 second, whereas even the best grandmasters can only juggle about 100 moves in their head at one time. And so the argument we're making, we call it the AI fallacy, is this idea that the only way we can sort out problems that human experts sort out through intuition and through judgment and through creativity by machines, the only way we could do that is to try and somehow copy the way that human beings work. And we're saying that's not really using the full power of computers. We should surely be trying to use the vast processing power, the huge data processing capabilities, to see if these machines can sort out some of these intractable problems in new ways. It wasn't us who said it, but there's many ways of being smart that aren't smart like us. That was Patrick Winston, one of the fathers of artificial intelligence. It's such an important observation. We tend to think the only way of being smart is human smart. And what we're seeing through machines is different ways of achieving outcomes that in human beings require intelligence. So again, I want to say to you, we're not suggesting these machines have cognitive states, that they think or they believe or their hopes and emotions in the same way as human beings, but in terms of outcomes, they're outperforming us. And if you take a simple example, then, as mentioned already, of tax, very few people like to pay in tax. People like even less the idea of paying someone to help you pay your tax. And so if we can develop systems that can allow us more directly to account to the revenue service without the intervention of human beings, and yet to a very high standard, very few people will be lamenting the poor tax advisors who've been disintermediated. So you can use that same argument by analogy in other areas of professional service.
It raises an important point, though, and it goes to your what you said before about, you know, a different conception of judgment, where it's a judge in a court exercising a judgment, about whether or not there are some tasks, some activities that even if these systems and machines could perform them better than human beings, we might not want them to, for moral reasons. So it's a moral question rather than a technical question.
Yeah, if there's different kinds of smart, there might also be different kinds of judgment, but I'm not sure we want a mechanical judgment.
That's precisely the point.
You know, many of us feel uncomfortable about the thought that a machine might issue a life sentence.
Yeah.
Even if it could reach...
It doesn't know what life is.
Precisely. You know, even if a machine could... make a more efficient decision about how to allocate finite resources in a hospital, and so, you know, we task it with turning off life support machines. We really, I think, many of us wouldn't want machines to be making decisions about turning off life support machines. Now, these are not technical questions; these are moral questions about what are the limits, where do we want to keep a human in the loop, and where don't we? And, you know, part of our book is to say we are. In many different professions, these systems are approaching the point at which we need to be having debates about this. We need to be thinking about where we might want to keep human beings, even if they solve problems less efficiently or less effectively.
If there's one current in the conversations with all the people in this area, it is that now is the time when we need to start thinking about this.
That's absolutely right. And that is a key point we make. We, in fact, draw an analogy. In England in the early 1980s, when in vitro fertilization and test tube babies were being discussed and remarkable developments in our labs were being made, it was, I think, rightly recognized that this would raise fundamental and very difficult ethical questions. And the government called upon a well-known philosopher, Mary Warnock, to lead a commission of inquiry and also to stimulate public debate on how we... within Britain felt about the idea of test tube babies and so forth. And policy was developed on the basis of this expression of public opinion. And we are calling in our book for a similar level of debate about those areas that we feel, even if machines are capable of conducting tasks, those areas where we're uncomfortable from an ethical perspective. And it's a vital public debate, as you absolutely correctly point out. We want to have that discussion sooner rather than later.
Yeah. We're talking to Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind, the authors of a new book called The Future of Professions, How Technology Will Transform the Work of Human Experts, from the Oxford University Press. We'll have more in a moment. This is actually a perfect time for a Wealthfront ad, isn't it? Because we're talking about how expertise can now be stored in digital systems. Wealthfront's a perfect example of a system that really doesn't work, of financial advisors who skim, like, I mean, a huge amount, 1-2, in many cases, 3% of what you make off the top every year to give you financial advice. That means they have to do 3% better for you just to break even. That is not the way to do it. In fact, they're not giving you the best advice because they're not as sophisticated as Wealthfront. I want you to visit Wealthfront.com and take a look at what they're up to. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. This is a long-term, I want to emphasize this, this is not day trading, it's not short-term investments. This is the where you put your money when you're putting it away for the long term, for your retirement, for college tuition, to buy a house, you know, the rainy day fund. But boy, is this a great solution. Because instead of charging you 1, 2, or 3% of what they manage, they charge you 1/4 of 1%. 1/4 of 1%. And they manage your money better. There are never any hidden fees. There's no, you know, which most brokers will charge you transaction fees and commissions. No. 1/4 of 1%, and that's it. It's not surprising that they've gotten to almost $3 billion in assets under management, and they grow so rapidly because people are getting great results from Wealthfront at a lower cost. The computer does a better job. Plus, it's completely transparent, 24/7 accessibility. You can view all your accounts in one place on your computer, on your mobile. They're personal, for your personal account, your joint account, your retirement account. You'll see every trade they make on your behalf. It's actually kind of fun. I've heard from a number of Wealthfront customers, people who heard about it on the show, who said, I love watching this because, you know, they're rebalancing all the time, like daily. They're reinvesting. They're keeping you in a sector by moving money around. They're doing very sophisticated stuff like tax loss harvesting to make sure that your returns are maximized, your taxes are minimized. 90% of portfolios out there are not invested the right way for the long term. Sometimes because people do it themselves, sometimes because they get bad advice. Wealthfront is it. It's based on Nobel Prize winning academic research and the best investment practices from the best minds in this business. I want you to try it. Of course, read, as they always say, read carefully before investing. I want you to read all about it. You know, really understand what they're doing. You can do that at wealthfront.com/triangulation. I do like this. Most funds, you have to put a lot of money in to start. You could start with an investment of $500. That's the minimum investment, as little as $500. But if you go to wealthfront.com/triangulation, they'll manage your first $15,000, not for 1/4 of 1%, but free forever. So that's a great way to get that nest egg growing. It's a kickstart for your nest egg. Wealthfront, this is such a good idea. I just saw an article about how brokers are freaked out, as they should be. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. Where was that? That was in, I think it was in Bloomberg. They were writing about Wealthfront and how the traditional investment advisors are going. But this is exactly what we're talking about. The expertise, what you really need. It's not, you don't call an investment advisor to get, you know, empathy. You call them to get good advice. Wealthfront does it better. This is such an interesting subject, and sometimes I feel like we're moving towards a future where we almost come to the decision as humans, oh, we shouldn't let these grubby little sacks of meat make decisions about life and death. We really ought to let the machines do it because they'll do a better job. Maybe we're just, you know, fighting a losing battle. Maybe this is our monkey mind saying, wait a minute, not, you know, don't. I must have a role here somewhere.
Sadly, a few weeks ago, Marvin Minsky, one of the great fathers of artificial intelligence, passed away. And I remember quoting him when I was doing my research in this area in the 80s. He said, the next generation of machines will be so intelligent, we'll be lucky if they keep us around as household pets.
Yeah.
And that's always stuck in my mind. I think if you read Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence, if you haven't had Nick on the show.
We've interviewed him on the show. We have.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Good. So, yeah. I mean, Nick really explores this in considerable detail. And one of the issues we consider is the extent to which work is fundamental to the human condition. We naturally assume that we all work. But are there other ways that we can lead fulfilling and meaningful lives? And back after the time of the great philosophers, when people talked about meaningful lives involving poetry and ballet and song and sports and so forth, the book we hope will encourage people to give deeper thought to what it is that's the distinctive contribution that humans can make and how it is we can live good lives.
Yeah, and in an ideal world, work would have meaning. It would be more than making a living. It would be making a difference. You have to wonder what happens to all the people who are displaced by this. You know, I don't find Marc Andreessen's argument very persuasive. Well, everything will be so cheap, plentiful, that you don't need to work. I find that difficult to believe.
It raises really big distributional questions. It's absolutely right. If you think of the economy as a big pie, and a slice of that pie goes to labor in the form of wages and income, and then the rest of it goes to people who own these systems and machines in terms as rent or rent on capital. You know, what we see across Europe and in the US is that the slice of pie going to people who own these systems and machines is getting bigger. And a world in which a small number of people hold a large share of the productive assets, the systems and machines in the economy, whereas everybody else is struggling to make a living by earning a wage, that's a pretty dystopic future. And so these distributional questions about who owns and controls all these new systems and machines, I think are becoming sort of alive again. That people were interested in them in the 1950s and 60s, and again, I think they sort of exciting people.
We're not going to go back to the...
Just one thing to say, though, is that while I think these long-term questions about superintelligence and the threat of strong AI are interesting and important, we need to be careful not to let that have a chilling effect on our use of technology today. The courts, if you walk into a court in England and Wales, you're likely to see a fax machine. The current use of technology in the professions is so wildly out of step with those visions of the future, and we need to make sure that there's not a chilling effect from looking too far ahead. Because the great promise, and it's one of the themes of our book, of these new technologies, is that they offer people who currently don't have access to professional advice, what we call it the latent demand, this kind of great sea of unmet demand for education, for healthcare, for legal advice, to know how to run a business and so on. But it's currently unmet, and these systems appear, or at least are trying to meet that demand. If you talk to people about MOOCs, for example, massive online open courses in the US, first thing people will say is that a huge number of people signed up to them. The second thing people will say is that only a small number of people completed the courses. And so, this new technology is it's faddish, and it'll fail and drift away. But the most important thing to notice there is that hundreds of thousands of people are using these systems and looking for better educational services. There is a vast sea of unmet need for the sorts of solutions the professions traditionally offered, and they're simply not doing it. Now, it may be that MOOCs aren't meeting it yet, but that there is this need, and we should be thinking about how we can use technology to meet it.
They signed up for a reason, yeah.
Well, that's exactly right.
Right.
Yes, the appetite clearly for learning and for education is vast. That's the most significant point. We find it interesting that people imagine that the current generation of MOOCs is the best it will ever be. We say of so many technologies, actually, the current versions are the worst they're ever going to be. These technologies are just getting better and better with succeeding generations, greater human ingenuity being applied, market forces urging people in a competitive spirit to develop ever more useful systems. So the least likely future, we think, is that nothing will change.
You talk about Paul Krugman's hot dog maker, and the net change in jobs was zero, because even though people lost jobs making hot dogs, there were new jobs found in supporting automation and writing the software and so forth. Is it that kind of world we're talking about, a kind of a net of no change?
So this is the really interesting question. The optimists say, the pessimists say there's not going to be enough work for human beings to do in the future. And the optimists often say in response, the pessimists, you're wrong. You're committing the lump of labor fallacy. And this is what Paul Krugman was partly trying to pull out in his piece. The lump of labor fallacy is a fallacy because it's belief that there exists some fixed lump of work to be divided up between people and machines. And so if machines do more, then necessarily people will do less. And the great insight from that, from the Paul Krugman hot dog story, is that as the economy gets more productive, the lump of work grows. So people displaced from certain areas can get work elsewhere.
One hopes.
Now, in the book, we argue we don't challenge this belief that necessarily in the future there will be more work to be done. The economy is growing; it's becoming more productive. Of course, there's going to be more work to done. But what we are challenging is the belief that necessarily people, rather than machines, will be best placed to perform those tasks in the long run. You can concede the idea that the economy is growing and the lump of labor fallacy is wrong. But there's then a further fallacy to think that the additional work that is added onto that lump of initial work is necessarily stuff in which people rather than machines have the comparative advantage.
Example is Uber. A lot of displaced workers are driving now, but that ain't going to last.
That's exactly right. No matter how much demand there is to get from A to B in a city in a world of driverless cars, it's not going to lead to any employment for traditional drivers. Now, that's not then to say that there won't be new roles elsewhere performing very, very different types of tasks. And that's certainly the case in the medium term. But what technology is doing is it's changing the sorts of things that people are doing in their jobs, as we were saying before. But I think there are reasons to challenge that long-run optimism, particularly when you see the encroachment of technology on tasks that traditionally we thought were simply out of reach of automation and computerization.
Well, I want to, in our final segment, talk about where do we go and what do we do and how do we prepare. We're talking to Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind, the authors of The Future of the Professions, How Technology Will Transform the Work of Human Experts. There is very good news, by the way, Daniel. Economists and talk show hosts can never be replaced by machines. I'm counting on that.
No, it's because it makes me think, actually. I teach economics and I teach maths at Oxford University. And Khan Academy, as I was saying before, online collection of instructional videos and practice problems, I use it in my class. Salman Khan is a better... He can teach certain types of maths far better than me.
Sure.
And not only that, but, I don't have a rewind and a pause function for everyone in the class. They can go away and work through it themselves. So I think the idea that and what we're saying in the book is challenging the idea that we treat our work as a monolithic, indivisible lump of stuff. And actually, lots of us do tasks that can be done very, very differently through technology.
And Leo, you should also have a look at the work of Professor Ishiguro in Japan, who works on androids and humanoids. And there's some good online, on YouTube, some good clips of his newscasters that actually look like human beings.
Oh, arms. Dear.
So don't get too comfortable in your seat.
Well, we have a secret project in the basement where we're taking all the video. I do 24 hours of this a week, and we're ingesting it into an artificial intelligence. And I think by my demise, we shall have an artificial Leo, and I can continue forever.
Well, joking aside, we had a look at Ishiguro, and he, and you can see this online, the humanoid he's made of himself, when you see the photograph of his face and the humanoid next to one another, it's pretty hard to see which is the human being and which is the robot, as it were. And apparently, this humanoid actually sometimes gives some of his lectures.
It's a little uncanny valley, but we have it actually here. Here he is presenting. I don't know. Wait a minute, is that him or is that a robot?
Him.
Oh, God.
Well, you
okay.
Tell me.
The book is The Future of Professions. We'll have more. We'll have more in a moment. I want to talk about your website. Do you have a website? You ought to have a website. If you're a business and you don't have a website, that's weird, right? I don't, even if, you know, if I'm calling a plumber, I want them to have a website. I want to know about them. I want to know, you know, and that's, that, you got to have a website in business. You, and frankly, if you want to manage your reputation online, you better darn well have your own website personally as well. And if you're saying, oh, no, I have Twitter, I have Facebook. No, you need to have a place you call your own. And you know what's great? You go to squarespace.com. It's easy to set up. It's very affordable to run. It's going to look great. And all of your social networks are pumped right into it. You can connect it to Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. In fact, if you go to my site, leoville.com, perfect example. I created the cover page, the slideshow in the front. But right there, there's not only a link to my blog and my calendar, my photos, but also to my Facebook, to my Twitter, to my Instagram, to my YouTube. And I could do more, LinkedIn and everything. And that's all automatic. Go to my blog page. You'll see on the right gutter, you can see recent posts on the blog. But scroll down, you'll see recent tweets. You'll see recent Instagram posts. You can do all of that automatically, easily. So it integrates into your life, but it becomes your home on the web, and you really need to have that. And man, are they gorgeous. I tell you what, you're starting with designer templates, but you can get fancy. And I got to tell you, Squarespace is the only web host that will make your shopping cart look every bit as good as your site, because it is your site. You don't have a separate mobile site, it's mobile responsive. You don't have a separate shopping cart, it's built in. These templates are designed by the best designers, the best engineers, to be state of the art. You've got to try it. And you can try it right now free at squarespace.com. Do use our offer code Triangulation if you decide to buy, because you'll get 10% off. And they'll say, oh, you've been watching Triangulation. Uh-huh. We got to buy more ads there. That's kind of how it works. Squarespace.com. Please use the offer code Triangulation for 10% off. Squarespace. You should. This is, of course, a topic of eternal fascination. In fact, really all we do on this network is talk about the changing world and how we adapt to it. And if you're in the professions, maybe you thought doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, you'd be safe. Maybe not. The world is changing, and the future of professions may not be as you think. Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind are the authors of this new book, and we've been talking to them for the past hour. How should we go forward? How should, you know, I have I have two children in college. You know, there's a lot of people watching who are worried about losing their jobs. There are people now deciding what to study. How should we go forward? What should we do?
I think we can answer that at two levels. At the level of particular professions, we really want a lead to be taken by the thought leaders, the opinion formers, the policymakers within the professions. So if I can take the area I work in, which is the law, in England, we're very fortunate in having a Lord Chief Justice, for example, who's championing the idea of online courts. We have leading law firms that are sympathetic to the delivery of legal services in new ways. And the narrative from them and from us is for the medium term, through the 20s at least, there's a whole bundle of new jobs and new challenges that are still going to require human beings, and we should be addressing these. And so in our book, we will provide a list of jobs for the future, the knowledge engineers, the process analysts, the system designers, the empathizers, the moderators. Most professionals look at that list and don't really much fancy doing that for a living. We argue, and have experience to back it up, that actually these jobs can be as stimulating, if not more stimulating, than traditional professional work. They're just very different. And so what we would like and would call upon our professions to do is to embrace and lead the change, to acknowledge that as we move from a print-based industrial society to a technology-based internet society, we need to rethink the way we share what we call practical expertise in society. And practical expertise is the knowledge, the experience, the know-how, the skills that professionals apply in their daily work. And we're saying there's six new models for producing and distributing expertise in society. Because interestingly, that's what it comes down to. Leo, we started off thinking we were writing a book about the future of the professions, but we actually ended up writing a book that asked and answered the question, how do we produce and distribute expertise in society? Expertise is a scarce resource, and we've identified, and we've been discussing it over the last hour, different ways in which that expertise can be generated, whether it be in social networks or perhaps even machine-generated. And we invite, we urge the professions, each and every one of them, to look hard at the way they deliver services, to acknowledge that most of them are creaking and unaffordable, to embrace the new techniques, to train our next generation of professionals not to be 20th century professionals, but to be 21st century professionals, and thus equip our society with better healthcare, better legal care, better educational service, better business service, and so forth. So that, at the level of individual professions, is what we call upon. And there's also issues at a higher level for governments. And it seems to us what we're saying here is that tomorrow's economy, is, as Daniel was discussing, is going to depend on a very different form of wealth creation, less contingent on labour, more dependent on capital, this new capital, the intellectual capital, and the systems that support and deliver it. And we need governments to recognise this and to plan accordingly, to plan tax systems accordingly, welfare systems accordingly, to think about how this asset is redistributed.
Yeah.
Really a pivotal stage in the development of society.
You've ended up writing a manifesto for the liberation of expertise, which I'm all for. But I have to think that the current gatekeepers, the current maintainers, I mean, I don't know if we're going to see a bewigged barrister, a Ned Ludd barrister. I don't know what you're... using his gavel to break down the looms of, I don't know. The metaphor gets all
fuzzy
here. But I worry about that. It's a disruptive thing you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember, it's not the purpose of the law to provide a living for traditional lawyers.
They may disagree, however.
They may disagree, but it's not the purpose of ill health to provide a living for traditional doctors. You know, the professions exist to solve these problems, and they're creaking. And I think, you know, as we go into the future, and it's one of the lessons that one of the ideas that we finish on is to keep the recipients in mind. You know, the professions exist to solve these problems, and if we can find better, more efficient, more effective ways of giving people access to a good education, improving their healthcare. These are things that we should embrace rather than reject. The point you raise about gatekeepers is a really interesting one. I think one way to think about what's happening with the rise of companies like TurboTax and patients like me LegalZoom and WebMD, so on is that we're seeing the decline of the old gatekeepers, the professions. You know, each of them were in the past responsible for looking after their own kind of respective bodies of expertise. But we're now seeing the rise of a new set of gatekeepers, potentially. New organizations and different types of people who are taking control of these bodies of incredibly valuable and important expertise. So while there's the promise of a liberation of expertise, there's also the threat, potentially, of a new set of gatekeepers pulling up the drawbridge. And you can see in some of the professions, this is starting to happen, and it's
not just the professions. I mean, we've always had in the professions licensing bodies designed to do this. But even now, in the United States, it's a massive problem. If you want to become a barber, you need 400 hours of training. I mean, it's rent taking. The existing barbers are making sure that no one else can become a barber.
And our book, in many ways, is a challenge. What we call in the profession the grand bargain, this granting of exclusivity to occupational groups, essentially pulling up the drawbridge so only the providers who are in play just now are allowed to engage and be involved, which does lead to another issue, which is whether or not we can and should expect the professions themselves to change. Further to what I was saying earlier, Are we letting the rabbits guard the lettuce here? Does it make sense to expect these deeply entrenched, highly successful professionals themselves to institute the change that will bring about the demise of their old ways of working? What we're finding is that most professions see the need for change in other professions other than their own. And so the motivations within professions to change, we don't believe are strong enough. And this is why government intervention on the one hand, or we believe in a liberalization, which allows the participation of non-professionals in professional tasks, that'll create the stimulus that's required to change the way the professionals work.
And here I thought I was interviewing two members of the establishment, a holder of the Order of the British Empire and the fellow in the Royal Society of Edinburgh, a lecturer at Balliol. Instead, you guys are radicals. You're going to...
Thank you.
It's a manifesto, my friends. Actually, it's fascinating, and it's really important, too. The future of professions, Richard Susskind and Daniel Susskind, they are wolves in sheep's clothing, but the book is really good from the Oxford University Press. And food for thought, and obviously very important to all of us as we go forward into, as you say, the 20s. That kind of took me off guard at first, and then I realized, oh, yeah, we're headed to the 20s.
You'll use that phrase again.
I love it. Maybe even the roaring 20s, who knows? thank you so much, Richard and Daniel, for your time. I really appreciate it, and thank you for the book. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Leo. It's been a great pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us. Great pleasure.
We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1900 UTC. I hope you'll tune in live because, of course, the chat room and the interaction we get from you in the live chat room really is valuable to me, helps me steer the conversation. But if you can't, of course, on-demand audio and video is available after the fact. twit.tv/TRI. You can also subscribe. In fact, I hope you will because we have audio and video on demand everywhere, on Roku, on Apple TV, on Windows and iOS and Android. Just look for either a podcast app or one of our Twit apps. There are quite a few of them now written by our fans, and we thank you for doing that. Thank you for watching, and I'll see you next week on Triangulation.